Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Jerusalem Post. Israel strikes Iranian airbase. Tehran signals no response. Australia tells citizens to evacuate Israel. Anti-Israeli activists condemn attack on Iran. American signals approval of IDF Rafah op. Explosions heard in southern Syria, Iran. In other words, the chaos of war, the fog descends. The Times of Israel. Global community urges Israel, Iran to keep a lid on tensions after reported strike. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, writing about the exchange now, we're told, of attacks by Israel and Iran this last week that appears to have changed the contest throughout the Middle East. No longer is Iran working through surrogates with minimal deniability. It used Iranian soil to fire missiles and drones against Israel, and Israel has now responded by attacking near an airbase that is sometimes said to be associated with a nuclear weapons suspect site. Richard, a very good evening to you.
Yes.
The exchange here, you write in Defining Ideas for the Wall Street Journal, describes contests between adversaries in law, sometimes contract law, sometimes criminal law.
Yeah.
And what we're looking at is signals back and forth, according to Washington and according to the capitals of Europe. Signal response, but don't go too far. Proportionate response has been used these last days. How does the negotiation that lawyers do routinely between adversarial clients inform what we're witnessing now on a world scale? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Well, the little piece there said, suppose you want to do business with somebody whom you've chosen and would like to partner. Almost invariably, you put your best foot forward. You risk a little, but you gain the confidence of the other side. And as the exchanges go on in a positive way, things get better and better. And even though these arrangements may be terminable at will on both sides, they could last many, many years because of the accumulated capital that people have in the relationship makes it very difficult for them to want to breach because it's not going to be in their own interest. But unfortunately, in international affairs, you don't get to pick your own enemies. They get to pick you. And if you apply that strategy and put your best foot forward, it becomes appeasement and the foot gets cut off. So what you have to do is you have to start making maneuvers. And the basic rule that you have to adopt is one of no trust, which says if we get it right, we manage to get something that's large. But if they do the worst possible thing, it turns out that we're no worse off than we were before. That's the way in which you want to play it. So to give you an example, which I didn't put in the paper, in the civilian set, one of the reasons you have to ask is why during labor negotiations in the United States, when unions were first getting a footing, or in the civil rights movement, do people start to use sit-ins? Well, a sit-in is a violation and it's a trespass, but it's not the violent use of force in one form or another. So what you're doing is you're basically planting your flag on their territory and you dare them to give a response because it turns out the only kind of response they could give is one which is much more severe than the step that you took. And very many people are reluctant to send the police in to drag people out because they think it's going to go against them. And so if you look at the recent Columbia thing, they were doing the sit-in strategy for months, sitting there on the major greens of Columbia and the lawns. And then what happens, they have the hearing in Washington, and all of a sudden, there's now an excuse that you could go in, and the escalation that you're going to do has come from Congress. And so Columbia's very shrewd president. What she did is she basically removed all the people from the lawns in front of Butler Library because the lanes had changed to make this go. So in the Middle East, what the Israelis did is they knew that they, when they struck and killed those five generals, that there was likely to be a response. But they also knew that it was a targeted strike and it did not have any collateral consequences like the indiscriminate use of missiles. And the Iranians, unfortunately, cannot retaliate in kind, thank God, because they don't have the sophistication in order to do it or the intelligence network in Israel or anything else. So they throw this huge bombardment and telegraph it in advance saying, hey, we want to hurt you, but we don't want you to escalate. And it turns out the Israelis demonstrate a powerful air defense, which should unnerve everybody who wants to attack them. And then the question is, what do you do next? The worst military strategists in our times today is a cross between Anthony Blinken and Joe Biden. And they say, do absolutely nothing. You never tie your hands like that gratuitously. If it turns out that you can do something which is going to hurt them, but make it very awkward for them to retaliate by escalation, you do it. And if they try to take out the nuclear facility in the middle of Iran, that might have done it. But what they were able to demonstrate is, we can penetrate your defenses, or we can land a bomb there. You don't even know what's happening. And when you wake up in the morning, what you have to realize is that what we have shown you is whatever electronics you have, ours are a generation ahead of yours, and you can't win this kind of a war. And the Iranians, they may be vicious, cruel, and mean, and they surely are that, but they're not completely crazy. And so what they started to think about was no more escalation to take place. Now, what does it get Israel? Well, again, another one of Joe Biden's worst decisions, he wants to preserve the status quo in Gaza, some kind of a ceasefire with no resolution of the issues. But the Israelis have to take that Rafah. There's just nothing they can do to negotiate a post-settlement if Hamas is still around. And several of my friends have asked me, suppose you win, what happens next? My answer is, it's really terrible, and I'm not quite sure what you're going to do. But at least you're in control. If you let this go on and somebody asks you what's next, is you're going to have to fight another round with Hamas. And to quote one of my new heroes, Miss Hillary Clinton, when she goes to Wesley, she said, rather to Wellesley, she says, you know, there was a ceasefire in place on October 6th. Is that what you want to do again? You have to take them out, because there's no ceasefire that's worth the paper that it's written on. So the Israelis will try to do it. You try to avoid any civilian casualty that you possibly can. Hamas will try to increase the number of civilian casualties in some way, even of its own people, in order to make the Israelis look terrible. But if the Israelis stick to it and the United States butts out, it might come to a reasonably sensible situation. But if you leave it open, we know what's going to happen next. Iranians are going to flood the West Bank and Israel with various kinds of small weapons to disrupt things there. There'll be actions by Hezbollah. And it may well be that Hamas could then rise out of the grave and do its damage in Gaza, or they may support things from Iran itself. And there's also the Houthis in the Red Sea. So the Israelis, they cannot have the luxury of letting all of these people pick the time when they want to attack. They have to fight the instabilities of the current time and take advantage of the situation as it does, because of the splendid work that they did. One of the most influential people in this debate lately has been a man named John Spencer, whom I've never heard of before. But he gives really very precise accounts of how good the Israelis are at doing what they're doing, and how utterly disastrous the kinds of tactics that Joe Biden wants to use, piecemeal assaults on various places, are. This reminds me of what my Uncle Albert told me when I was 11 years old. He was in the Second World War. And he said, you cannot win the land war through the air. He says, you have to have feet on the ground to control the territory, and you have to have it comprehensive. And it's that lesson that Spencer talked about recently in the New York Post. And you read this guy and say, hey, here is somebody who seems to know what's going on. And so what you do is you try to take your instructions. And the whole point about warfare is, again, you try to take advantage of those situations which maximize your gain and minimize the risk of retaliation, which means, in effect, there are limits of what you can do, because if you go too far, you will bring third parties in against
there's
you.
A headline, but if you don't... There's a headline that supports your case, Richard. It's good. In the Times of Israel just now. Iran says no retaliation planned as both sides seek distance from Isfahan attack. That sounds like a successful negotiation. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's what you're hearing. Is what the Iranians have said is they can't calibrate something that's going to fall in the zone from being pathetically weak on the one hand to terribly overdone on the other hand, because what they don't have is they don't have the kind of precision information and intelligence about Israel that Israel has about them. And my guess is, you know, they're probably pretty sophisticated. But the Israelis, they're sophisticated, and the Israelis are geniuses when it comes to this stuff. And the single most important feature in this war, which is often neglected, is the enormous human capital that the Israelis have in a full range of technical kinds of activities. And this has made them a power in all sorts of civilian activities, you know, building ways and other systems to get you along the highway. But it also has huge military risks. And you don't want to go into an electronic war with somebody who could jam your systems and you can't jam that. So what they've done is they're trying to neutralize Iran, and we'll then force them back to the proxy wars. And sooner or later, they're going to have to take out Rafah, and sooner or later, they're going to have to take out Hezbollah.
I want to introduce a wild card here. Within 48 hours, the president of Iran had made a phone call to the president of Russia. And the other announcement in that sphere is that the president of Russia in the Persian press was quoted as praising Iran's attack on Israel because it was triggered by the criminal act, meaning Damascus, the strike in Damascus. So Russia is clearly siding with Iran, has been for some time. The question is, how does that change the negotiation between Tehran and Jerusalem?
I don't think it changes that particular negotiation. But again, what it shows you is if you go too far and you bring the Russians in, that's the peril. I think the Russian influence and the Iranian influence has much more to bear in Ukraine than it does in Israel, because we're not just the Ukrainians can beat the Russians. And what they can seem to beat are the Russians who get materials from North Korea, China, and Iran in order to supplement their own military activities. And just as we're fighting a kind of a proxy war, half-heartedly, I might say, in Ukraine, the Russians have greater support from other individuals. If it had been the situation when the Americans had intervened and the Europeans on the back and the Iranians against the Russians alone, this war would be over in the opposite direction. But that's not what's happening. So I think it's the Ukraine front which is more dangerous. And as far as I'm concerned at this particular point, I don't think Israel at this time needs military assistance from the United States in order to take out anything that the Iranians are likely to do, except the kind of stuff that we already gave them, which is shoot down missiles.
One more concern, Richard. This looks like not the end of the story. It looks like a pause, like a chapter heading. And history suggests that escalation continues. Do you measure that the escalate? We've got a new red line, and that is to be crossed.
Look, I'm sure there will be some kind of escalation, but my guess is that the most important regulation now is to move very decisively in Gaza to take the Hamas out. And if that is regarded as an excellent, you know, as a kind of escalation, then so be it. The really irresponsible situation is you read Joe Biden writing in the Wall Street Journal, and he says, we're behind Israel 100%, but we don't want them to do anything in Rafah. You cannot play that particular game. This is not the kind of war where you can straddle. And you have to pick one side or the other. And if you pick Hamas, you're basically embracing death to everybody who gets in their way. And the Israelis have shown remarkable restraint and precision, according to Spencer, in the way in which they've conducted this war, much more so than we did when we went into Iraq and took after ISIS and so forth. So I think, in effect, what we want the United States to do is to just shut up and not to grandstand, and to let the Israelis take care of business on the ground. And once the situation is done with Hamas, then you're going to have to see whether they're going to try to escalate again. And my view is that Hezbollah wants to do exactly what we talked about, be enough of a nuisance so that you can impede their activity, but not so much of a nuisance that they're going to come in and bomb it.
We need to go to a talking part of the U.S. government, Richard.
Oh, that's fine.
Yes, the Supreme Court.
Oh, God. Yes.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, resolving the conflict for now between Iran and Israel. We're now on to the Supreme Court and the January 6th hearing held these last days in oral arguments. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What if every student had a tutor and personalized learning was available to everyone? What if every family had a financial guide and their investments made for an optimistic future? What if every doctor could diagnose you in seconds and healthcare visits felt more personal? What if your business never slept and every customer's shopping experience felt like it was designed especially for them? It can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.